science and technology in our lives. Then throw in some culture, history, ethics, philosophy, and religion. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. Big data, artificial intelligence, privacy policies. There's a lot out there right now in the world of tech that the average person doesn't understand. But what's sad is that even though you may not understand it, it still is affecting your life in a very personal, and some may say even invasive way. Today we're talking about the humanitarian concerns behind the use of artificial intelligence and big data. Today our guest is Dr. Rumen Choudhury. She is a data scientist and a big player in the Silicon Valley AI scene. But she also approaches AI from a social science background, which gives her a unique insight not only into how AI works, but how it is affecting our life. So welcome to the podcast, Rumen.
Thank you for having me.
So let's first of all talk about exactly what AI and big data is. So a lot of people have this sort of fatalistic idea or something that you would see in the movies about what AI is and how it might take over the world. So there's a lot of misconceptions that are out there. So what exactly are we talking about when we're talking about AI and big data in this context?
There is a lot of discussion about AI and its potential. So where AI is today is not as capable of creating these futuristic worlds that some people are talking about. What they talk about is something called artificial general intelligence, which would mean an AI is capable of learning the way a person can. We're not quite there yet. We're in the world of narrow AI, which is we have artificial intelligence trained to do very specific tasks. So currently, it is worth having discussion about where AI might be headed or where we might be sending it. But right now, we don't live in a world yet where every move is being constantly monitored all of the time.
But there is some sort of concerns about how AI might be impinging upon human rights right now. So when we're talking about this, what kind of human rights are we concerned with?
To be honest, we are concerned with just about every human right out there. So a caveat to my previous statement, we have narrow artificial intelligence, but that narrow artificial intelligence is able to do some pretty sophisticated things. Most recently, there was an article about how somebody created an algorithm to be able to identify people who had their faces covered, and they used it as an example to identify protesters. Now, in an authoritarian government where the people protesting are fighting for their freedom, you can see how this could be incredibly dangerous and very harmful for people. So there is some concern, and it's pretty valid. I think what the conversation should be is about, you know, what are the ethical guidelines that we ourselves are willing to impose upon ourselves about what sort of behavior and what sort of research is appropriate?
When we're thinking about the different types of concerns that we might have, we hear about personal data a lot of times. So what do we consider as personal data, especially the type of things we might want to safeguard against companies using it in a way that we aren't very comfortable with?
That's a really good question, and that area is getting more and more fuzzy and more gray. So we have started to try to make legislation to define that space. So there is no hard and fast answer any longer. And I'll give you an example. People were pretty outraged about a year ago when somebody scraped OkCupid data off of the web and used it to, you know, do some sort of analysis. Now, in that person's defense, or that person's defense of his work, was that all of this was publicly available on the OkCupid website. But for the people who put it out there, it was very personal and sensitive information that they did not consent to being used that way. And that's the space that legislation is trying to define. So the EU is probably the most at the forefront with all of this, and they are working on something called the GDPR, which is going to be in effect in 2018, and it has data privacy regulations. But there are people who say that the guidelines that are defined in GDPR are either ambiguous or insufficient or not quite there yet. So it's a space that we're trying to figure out.
I think a lot of things that people don't understand is how in-depth AI gets with our personal data. So let's say we give some data that we may not think is that sensitive, but there's something called big data that a lot of times it can make inferences about who we are and our habits from these little bits of data. So how exactly does that work?
So big data has been a concept that's been around for a while. For probably about the past 10 years or so, big data was our first step into the world we live in today. And that this was when we started to get a distributed file system, so a Hadoop system, which is a term you've probably heard. It is a way of accessing large amounts of data in a way that was not possible before. And given that that accessibility to data was made possible, this was when we started to be able to tap into big data. We've been giving all of these companies our data for a very long time. The companies did not necessarily have an easy, cheap, fast way to access and analyze this data until somewhat recently. So this is where big data comes in. We're constantly giving, let's say, our GPS information from our phone every single time, whenever we move around, because our phone is constantly pinging cell phone towers. Now, our cell phone provider has this information. They've kept this information for a very long time, didn't really have much to do with it. But now they're able to use this information if they wanted to, let's say, figure out where your most likely daily patterns are, and maybe even figure out where you're likely to go tomorrow or the day after.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And so they can track where you are. Could they then, if you happen to walk by a coffee shop every morning, could they give you an ad on your computer then all of a sudden that's popping up for this coffee shop? Does it work like that?
It can, or you could think about it as you might get a push notification on your phone when you walk by that coffee shop. So the way that might work, and some stores already do this, you have to opt into it or you have to opt out of it, which is an interesting nuance that we might want to think about. But let's say you're driving by a store, you have that store's app. Some places will ping you on your phone and say, you are right near, you know, store XYZ. Here's a 10% off coupon, or, you know, it seems like you want to buy this product. So they that's already in play.
Yeah. And I know another big one is face recognition. A lot of people are uploading pictures of themselves or their friends to either Facebook or other photo sharing systems online. And a lot of times they have this automatic face recognition. They can tell which pictures you're in. And so to me, this seems like this could also be used potentially to get a lot of information about you that you may not think you're actually putting out there.
Absolutely. And I think Twitter and Facebook are really good examples, particularly Twitter, because it is only a public medium, or Instagram, if you've made your account public. So those, especially those social media that rely on speaking publicly, one might consider Facebook a more closed version of a social media and something like Twitter to be more of an open form of social media. Yes, the companies or other individuals or groups would be able to recognize your face, find your face in other images, in other media, in other pictures. For example, let's say you post a lot of pictures on Twitter, and a company is able to figure out through image recognition, not just that it's you in that picture, but that maybe you are holding a bottle of their competitor's brand of soda. And maybe then target you with an ad for their soda because they know that you more often drink their competitor's brand. Something like that. These are all this scenario is an incredibly feasible scenario and very, very possible.
So does this happen now, or is this something that might happen in the future?
I would not be surprised if it happens now. I don't have insight into the way ads work on specifically the social media platforms I've mentioned. I will say that completely anecdotally, my Facebook feed has often come up with ads for products that were related to tangential Google searches that I did or discussions I was having on other media platforms, not Facebook. So I have definitely noticed that happen.
Another thing, it's not just products, it's not just ads as well. There's a lot of ways that big data can be used to get information about you. You mentioned the political protesters earlier, to see if you're more likely to engage in a political protest or to be a liberal or a conservative or something like this. And there's also ways that people think, oh, you can also use this data to see if this person is more likely to speak out against the government or to be a terrorist or something like this, which may or may not be actually true about you. So this is another concern that could be a problem as well.
You touch on a great point. So the revolutionary thing about AI and predictive analytics and all this advanced analytics that we're able to do is that we are no longer in a reactionary world where things happen, we understand them postmortem, and then we try to take action for the future. What we are able to do now is attempt to predict things. And I specifically say attempt to, because all of these things, as you've mentioned, is a probability and not a certainty. And that's where I think the gray area comes in for people who are less knowledgeable about the way the algorithms work behind these technologies and AI and data science. It's that things are probabilistic, not certain. And that's, I think, an issue that people have understanding about probability anyway. Is it right? Is it fair? Is it ethical to draw conclusions that would impact somebody else's life on something that is probable? And here's where we start getting into kind of the murky area. If something is 97% probable, that still means there's a 3% chance it won't happen. And if the action one would take would be something extreme that would significantly impact that person's life, is it still worth doing? So to make it even more concrete, people like to think about the movie Minority Report. If it is 97% certain that somebody will commit a murder, is it right to imprison that person before they've committed that crime if there's a 3% chance they might not commit that murder?
And this is exactly, I think, what has the potential to happen right now, is that they're making inferences about your behaviors, but you haven't actually made those behaviors yet.
Exactly. So right now, I do want to take a step back before we get into the fatalistic world perspective and say that all of these things that we are talking about are not determined, they're not set to happen, and they don't have to happen. Human beings have agency over all of these actions. It may not seem like we do, but we as humanity, we as a population, we as educated individuals who are operating in the world have the power to make these things not happen, and it is our responsibility to. So I'm working on a book project where I use a term called moral outsourcing. And the idea of moral outsourcing is that our fatalistic and deterministic language about artificial intelligence is creating a world in which this is destined to happen, not because it has to happen, but because we're already pre-assuming it is, and we are acting as if it's not our responsibility to take that action. And I'll give you a very concrete example. It's in our semantics. When we say things like a racist algorithm or a sexist algorithm, simple grammar, we are putting the sexism or the racism onto the algorithm. The modifier shouldn't be on the algorithm. The modifier should be on the human. The algorithm just does what it was told to do, or it operates within the parameters that were defined for it. Now, it is the human's responsibility to either predefine parameters so things like that don't happen, which is possible, or have a fail-safe or a plan to mitigate in case that does happen. Now, these are all human actions. And by us, and when I say us, I mean media, I mean people in pop culture, using the language of applying this concept of racism or sexism or extreme behavior to the AI or to the algorithm, we're already cutting ourselves out of the picture.
And so we're not at the point where the AI, of course, is making decisions by itself. We're at the point where there are people behind it that are making these decisions. And so I guess this gets into what the morality and the ethics behind this actually comes in at the programmer's level or at the corporation level, where the people decide what they need and how they're going to use it. And so do you think that this should be something that companies should actively employ, like have people who are concerned with the ethics and the privacy and putting the people first rather than the business practices first?
I think that it should be a standard part of training of artificial intelligence engineers and data scientists to think about the moral, ethical, and societal implications of what they do. Having a separate body or arm or person is useful, but I think so much of it should be ingrained into what these people are doing in their day-to-day. So part of it is top-down, where there needs to be prioritization by management. So for example, there is a lot of pressure to release a product, to move quickly, right? Silicon Valley's motto is move fast and break things. But when you move fast and break things, cutting corners is very, very tempting. And these are the first corners you cut, right? Understanding if your sample is adequate for your population, understanding if there is some sort of a context to your application that might be negative for a probably most likely, by the way, an already marginalized subset of the population. So I'd also add, by the way, that artificial intelligence isn't making bad things happen. Artificial intelligence is reflective of the bad things that already exist in our society. So a artificial intelligence jobs algorithm shows women jobs that are for lower income than men, not because there's some inherent problem with the algorithm, but because as a society, we underpay women. So it points out our flaws. So by the way, one of the other contributors to the book, she's using a term called moral mirror, which I really love. So a key to creating an ethical guideline or a responsible guideline around AI is to put that morality upon ourselves first and understand what kind of society do we want and what are our goals, because we haven't even figured that out for ourselves yet.
And so I guess a big thing is to somehow be able to hold these algorithms and this AI accountable, and in turn, we're holding these businesses accountable for what they're doing. I feel like in today's society, a lot of the businesses, they're putting their business model ahead of their customers. And do you think that's part of the problem?
So I will say that I have noticed an increase in concern from companies and businesses about making sure they implement AI ethically. And I'll tell you why. For every business, at the end of the day, what they are concerned with is retaining their customers, right? Making sure people come back. Now, technology has made it completely seamless to, let's say, switch cell phone providers or switch your cable company or change your brand of shoes in a way that was never possible before. So that seamlessness actually empowers all of us as people to take action and show companies that this is not how we want our world to be. So the biggest case, I think, in Silicon Valley for this was Uber, where its practices were not things that people liked. And as a result of a lot of uproar from the Silicon Valley population, from people in general, there is a lot of change happening at Uber. So I will say that companies are concerned because of the accessibility that people have to their technology or to their company, and also how easy it is and how seamless it is to switch to their competitor in a way that was not really possible before. I think on the other end, for the biggest companies, there are people who are very concerned with how, you know, not building this AI dystopia, because that negatively affects everybody, including the richest of the rich, right? So this is very different from the Industrial Revolution, where you had these robber barons and they got very, very rich out of milking immigrants and poor people. While that may be something that could happen in the short term, in the long term, it's actually a lose situation for everybody, including the ultra wealthy. So I think everybody is concerned, and there is more and more discussion that I'm having with a lot of people about in these companies about how to think about applying AI ethically and morally. And the last part to that is, because it is so easy to communicate and spread a message, again, people, the regular person is more empowered than he or she used to be. We are able to put on social media immediately. If something is wrong, we can record real time. We can track things ourselves in a way that we were never able to track before. And to give you a stronger social example, it's not that cops weren't discriminating against minorities before. They always have been. We are just able to literally record it happening and have incontrovertible evidence of it. And then when the trial is in favor of the police officer who shot an innocent man, we know when we have proof, hard proof that we weren't able to have before, that this is something that's severely wrong with society.
And this is an interesting example that you're bringing up, because this is actually an example of how technology can actually be used for the people rather than for either the corporations or the bigger people that might have had a leg up in society previously.
Agreed. So we, as I mentioned, we will have the world that we make for ourselves. I genuinely think that all of these emerging technologies, including artificial intelligence, they are great tools and catalysts for democratization, for closing gaps and reducing barriers to entry. It's just our decision on how we want to shape our society to use these things. And so, for example, artificial intelligence could be used, and all these technologies can be used to make education free and available to every single person on the planet, no matter where you live. And all you would need would be some sort of a semi-functional laptop that can connect to the internet. And these things are possible. And then any child, any person, anywhere around the world can access a custom education and learn about so many things that are going on in the world in a way that was not possible before. That's only possible because of all these technologies that were created, and there are so many people working in the ed tech space to make that possible. Now, that was an active decision, right? So Coursera and any of these companies, MIT, OpenCourseWare, they could have decided to put all their material behind a paywall and make profit from it, or create for-profit online universities, any number of things. Instead, the democratization of this information has proven to be significantly more powerful and valuable, by the way, than creating a for-pay closed traditional model. And I would point to the open source community and a lot of this democratization that's happening today as an indicator of where we could be headed. So as an example, when Google launches something like TensorFlow, which is arguably the most used artificial intelligence set of algorithms that are out there today, everything about TensorFlow is free, fully available, created by Google. There are tutorials, there are YouTube videos, everything is free. Google doesn't stop people from creating a video about TensorFlow. They don't stop people from sharing their information. In fact, they encourage it because it actually increases Google's value and increases Google's revenue. So it's a very powerful thing, and it's a change we've already seen happen.
You're mentioning the free information through various courses, and you also mentioned the Uber example, mm-hmm. where people were able to understand what was going on. But I think a lot of times also as a society, we don't understand how these corporations are using our data. There's a lot of non-transparency behind what's being done. What do you think is a solution for this? Should there be more accountability, or should there be actually legislation or oversight committees that are looking at these different corporations and actually seeing how they access the data or how they use the data? Or how can we actually approach this?
You've hit the nail on the head. That's the intent of things like the GDPR. I'm actually on an IEEE committee that is creating guidelines around ethics for AI and responsible AI. There are groups within Silicon Valley, like the Partnership for AI. So there are people coming together to try to create guidelines around what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And we do have precedents for this, by the way. When we were first able to start using genetic manipulation, we did have agreements on, okay, well, let's do these things, but let's not try to, let's say, clone a human. Let's not try to create designer babies. We do have precedents for what we're talking about here. In other words, the use of a technology that could go in one direction, but as a society, as professionals, came together and said, these are things we aren't going to do. Another maybe more extreme examples would be that the Nazis during World War II did a lot of horrific human experimentation, and in doing so, discovered a lot of things. But we have all agreed that we are not going to experiment on human beings, and we are not going to use that research or further that research because it's morally repugnant. So there is precedence for trying to create guidelines and understanding things. I think the difficult thing about AI is it's a less defined space than, let's say, testing on humans or even genetic manipulation. So that's where the gray area comes in. But there are committees and groups already forming to try to understand this future, which makes absolute sense. So yes, while we are not at the world of artificial general intelligence yet, we may be, and I'd rather we have a fire department before there's a fire than try to figure out who's going to put the fire out once the fire started.
Is there a big difference between how the United States deals with these issues and how Europe deals with these issues?
Yes, there are very cultural differences, and I think this is one thing that's being built into ethical frameworks. How do we appreciate the cultural nuances, so not just between the US and the EU, but also considering Eastern philosophies on ethics versus Western philosophies on ethics? So to answer your question, the EU tends to believe in the protection of the individual's privacy and the individual's rights, whereas we have a lot less legislation about that, particularly relating to data and how companies can use it. But, you know, let's say from an Eastern perspective, there are, let's say, guidelines or imperatives around the family unit versus society and how things would be ethically different depending on the perspective you're taking.
at some point, I think people also need to be able to understand how much privacy and how much their data is getting out there. And we all have a hand in trying to control our personal data. But when you don't know how it's being used, it's a little bit hard to do this. Like you mentioned face recognition, and this is in a public place. This might not even be something you're actively uploading to the internet. And so it feels like already people are losing control. And so how do you think people can regain control of their data? And how can we go about getting it to a point where we actually can control what we put out there?
Like you said, the biggest uses of AI has been in publicly available data that may be security camera footage from a public grocery store or something like that. I strongly believe that we do need to have guidelines and we do need to have some sort of understanding and control and to your end, transparency. So one of the imperatives in the GDPR is the right to rescind your data. So if you, even if you freely give your data to a company, let's say you sign up for an email address from some service provider, and then, you know, you find out later that that service provider was sold to another company who uses your information in a different way, you should have the right to not just shut your account, but to take back the information that you've provided over time. So another example would be if you wanted to shut your Facebook account down today, that would be fine, and you would no longer be contributing to Facebook, but they would have all this historical information on you that I believe at the current moment they own. So should people have the right to say, I actually want back the data that I gave you, and I don't want you to use any of that, even though I gave it to you at the time, because the situation has changed. Because when we first signed up for our Facebook accounts, at this point, 10 years plus ago, we were not able to do any of these things. How can we today, in good conscience, agree to share something?
Right. And I think that's an excellent point, is that a lot of these companies are just getting data, obtaining data, and they're just saving it. And until they can do something with it, and we don't know what that might be in the future, we don't know how much control we're giving them.
Absolutely. The Economist had an article entitled Data is the New Oil. I absolutely agree. It is a valuable asset that we are currently unable to tap to the extent that we could, but it is starting to crystallize what we could use this information for. And I think that's what's important about us as people understanding our rights, as well as communicating to companies with our wallets, you know, and any other way we can, what we consider acceptable and unacceptable.
So we talked a lot about how things can be used in a very positive way and how things can be used in a very negative way. And a lot of our personal information is out there that we may not even know about. How would you recommend that we move forward?
I think for every person, there's a different answer to that question. I think we also see a generational difference. Younger people do tend to embrace technology more wholeheartedly. They are more okay with sharing their public and personal information. So I think for every person, where that line is very, very different, which is why I think it's important to create guidelines that empower the person instead of creating a blanket regulation that applies to everybody, whether or not that's how we would want it to be.
It's a lot of interesting things that I don't think people necessarily think about on a day-to-day basis.
Except maybe me.
Well, in any case, thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing some of your insight with us. And hopefully it'll get people to think more about what they're putting out there in the world.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcasts. Spark Dialogue is produced by me, Elizabeth Fernandez. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen, and I hope you enjoy this podcast. If you do, take a little time to review it, either on iTunes or on Stitcher or wherever else you get your podcast episodes. These ratings really do help the podcast grow and reach more people. You can find Spark Dialogue on the web at sparkdialogue.com or on Twitter at sparkdialogue or facebook.com/sparkdialogue. This is Elizabeth Fernandez, and thanks for listening.